Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Tim Sharrock, who discusses the opportunities and dangers of the planned summit meeting between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Jacob LaBelle, a plaintiff in a lawsuit filed by Our Children's Trust that charges the U.S. government has failed to take sufficient action to address climate change, talks about his group's latest court victory. And Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, historian and author of the book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, who talks about the hidden history of the NRA, now identified with right-wing culture wars and white nationalism. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the Trump administration are suing California over the state's sanctuary laws, claiming they violate federal supremacy over immigration enforcement. In announcing the federal lawsuit in Sacramento, Sessions exchanged insults with Governor Jerry Brown and other officials. Sessions specifically called out Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf, who had publicly warned of pending federal immigration raids in the Bay Area. Sessions' lawsuit targets three specific state laws designed to protect immigrants. The California Values Act limits information sharing by state and local officials with federal immigration agents. The Immigration Workers Protection Act prohibits access by federal ICE agents to employer records. And the third is a law that gives state officials the right to inspect federal immigration detention centers to check for potential abuses. The lawsuit comes a year after the Trump administration attempted to take away funding from cities that have passed sanctuary laws but was blocked by a federal judge. Now, legal scholars expect an epic battle over federal versus state rights in immigration enforcement, which is likely to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. Sessions' Justice Department is relying on an Obama-era case where the Supreme Court set a precedent by throwing out most sections of a harsh anti-immigrant law in Arizona, upholding federal supremacy on immigration matters. Thus far, federal courts have seen split rulings over the federal government's power to compel local law enforcement to assist ICE agents in arresting undocumented immigrants. Prison reform in Costa Rica, focusing on a specific group of women, has been a successful model for other Latin American nations and around the world. Under this reform, known as 77 bis, and implemented in 2013, prison terms for women who were convicted of smuggling drugs into prison were reduced to a minimum of 3 to 8 years if they meet certain conditions. The new law also permits the use of alternatives to incarceration for sentences of 3 years or less. The immediate result of this reform was the initial release of female inmates, thus reducing overcrowding in women's prisons. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the law is an important symbolic break in Latin America, moving away from heavy sentences for drug crimes by promoting alternatives to reduce massive prison overcrowding. Across Latin America, the population of women inmates has surged over 50% since 2000. It was caused by rapid expansion of the international drug trade and lack of social programs for impoverished families. Because the male prison population over the last 15 years has risen more slowly, at 20%, penalties for drug crimes have disproportionately harmed women. Studies of female inmates who have been released from prison under the reform law found that less than 2% of women given alternative sentences have violated their parole or committed a new crime that put them behind bars. In a rare defeat for the National Rifle Association, Florida's Republican Governor Rick Scott signed a new gun safety law, which imposes a 3-day waiting period on gun sales and raises the legal age to purchase a firearm from 18 to 21. But the law doesn't ban assault weapons sought by student activist survivors of the Parkland School massacre, who marched on the state capitol. The NRA is now suing to block the law. For years, Florida, often nicknamed the Gunshine State, has been a home base for Second Amendment activists who pushed the infamous Stand Your Ground law cited in the shooting death of unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin. The state's longtime NRA director, Marion Hammer, has been aggressive and successful in advancing gun rights and vindictive in targeting opponents. but the clout of gun rights activists melted away after the February 14th massacre of 17 students at Parkland's Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. Students from the school led a new wave of protests against gun violence and advocated for a ban on the sale of military-style assault weapons like the AR-15 used in the crime. David Cole, legal director of the ACLU, noted, "Florida is often the first place where the NRA pursues specific gun rights protections that are often adopted by other states. Over the years, the Florida legislature has passed over 30 NRA-supported gun rights bills. The group's influence in Florida comes in part from over 300,000 active NRA members in the Sunshine State." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After a year of trading threats and insults with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, U.S. President Donald Trump accepted Kim's invitation for a face-to-face meeting by the end of May. In extending the invitation for a summit meeting, North Korea committed to a temporary halt to its nuclear and missile tests, even during joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises scheduled for April. A diplomatic initiative by South Korea's President Moon Jae-in succeeded in reducing tensions when the North agreed to participate in the South's Olympic Winter Games in February, setting the stage for the Trump-Kim Jong-un summit. Until last week, such a meeting seemed impossible, with Trump mocking Kim as Little Rocket Man and repeated threats to launch a preemptive military strike against North Korea, as well as the imposition of harsh new sanctions. Trump's direct threat to totally destroy North Korea, implying a U.S. nuclear attack, alarmed the world. Despite hope for a successful summit, there's concern that with little time for preparation and the sudden firing of U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un could end in failure, further escalating tensions. Your reporter spoke with Tim Sharrock, a Washington-based journalist who spent part of his youth living in South Korea. Here he assesses the chance for a successful summit and the opportunities and dangers of the planned meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un.
I think it's very important that there's going to be this face-to-face meeting. And, of course, it's going to, you know, take some effort of diplomacy to line things up before the meeting. But I think that's very possible. And I also think there's actually been a lot of backdoor discussions for the last year, even though there hasn't been much publicly said about that.
Tim, what are the concessions that North Korea has made here in order to get a positive response for this invitation they've made to President Trump?
Well, first of all, you know, apparently they've said they're willing to discuss, you know, eventual denuclearization. I mean, that's key, you know, to this for the U.S. And, you know, that was a major concession because they've, you know, they have said previously that they would negotiate around their nuclear capabilities only after the U.S. had ended its, what they call its hostile policy, quote unquote, which is something they've, a formula they've put forward many times. And by hostile policy, they mean, you know, these military exercises that take place twice a year. They mean the nuclear threats against North Korea, which, of course, you know, U.S. has plenty of nuclear weapons aimed at North Korea and has had them aimed at North Korea for decades. And also, you know, the sanction, ending the sanctions and the embargo on North Korea, which they see also as a hostile act. And so, you know, by saying that they're going to, you know, eventually they will talk about eventual denuclearization, that's a major concession right there. And then they told the South Korean delegation they understand why the U.S. and South Korea hold these exercises, and make a big issue out of the exercises when they start up again in March. But I think their understanding and the South Korean understanding is that these exercises will happen, but they'll be much more scaled down in the past. And in particular, these exercises won't include training in what the U.S. and South Korea have previously called decapitation teams that are would be sent into North Korea during a war to eliminate the leadership, assassinate Kim Jong-un. And, you know, in the past 2 years, they've actually had teams that were, you know, running through these exercises, you know, practicing that very act. And then, of course, they would train in, you know, nuclear attack on North Korea and that kind of thing during these exercises. So, you know, according to reliable reports in the South Korean press, those exercises are going to take place absent U.S. Nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, as well as nuclear submarines and nuclear-armed submarines. And then those ships and vessels will not participate. So, you know, that's the concession that I think the United States is not talking about.
Well, Tim, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you about the specter of failure here. I think pretty much everyone here in this country and around the world hopes for a successful outcome of this meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un and success for a peaceful resolution of the longstanding conflict on the Korean Peninsula. But what are the dangers of failure here? If President Trump goes to this meeting with Kim Jong-un and they can't agree on much, Donald Trump is known as a very vindictive man, and we've seen in the past his penchant for getting even. When it comes to, you know, a nuclear confrontation, that kind of posturing is extremely dangerous. What are you concerned about if there is a failure at the negotiating table?
Oh, well, I think you're right about that. I mean, I think there are definitely, you know, dangers and risks here. But the fact that South Korea is going to be very involved in these negotiations, even the bilateral, and Moon's idea is to have, you know, kind of consecutive parallel negotiations that are U.S.-North Korea, South Korea, North Korea, and, you know, other countries in the region together with North Korea. So there will be an international settlement. And the more countries get involved, not necessarily in pressuring North Korea like, you know, Trump has been trying to do, but in trying to, you know, find a regional solution to this. And I think there's dangers, but I think this could be a huge leap. It could be a huge deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine a peace agreement to end the Korean War that, you know, it would end 60, 70 years of war. And if you talk to people in Korea, they've been saying, you know, for months, they're much more worried about what Trump will do than Kim Jong-un. But what they were very worried about and what President Moon Jae-in was very worried about was the U.S., you know, taking unilateral military action against North Korea that, of course, would spill over into South Korea and could become a major war within hours. You know, it's a divided country, and the South Koreans, while they want to, you know, defend their land from any kind of invasion, they don't want to have a war that kills, you know, hundreds of thousands because of some, you know, unilateral decision made by the United States to destroy North Korea's nuclear program.
That was Tim Shorrock, a Washington-based journalist and author of the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Find links to Shorrock's recent articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 7th, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that a historic generational lawsuit charging that the U.S. government failed to take sufficient action to address climate change can go to trial. The 21 plaintiffs were 7 to 18 years old at the time the suit was filed by Our Children's Trust in 2015. With the court's unanimous ruling denying the Trump administration's motion to dismiss the case, the suit is now cleared for trial in federal district court in Eugene, Oregon. The litigation charges that the United States government, quote, has violated the youngest generation's constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property, as well as failed to protect essential public trust resources. The case rests on a principle called the public trust doctrine, which says that the government has a responsibility to safeguard certain public assets, in this case, a stable climate. In an earlier decision which favored the youth plaintiffs, District Court Judge Ann Aiken wrote, exercising my reasoned judgment, I have no doubt that the right to a climate system capable of sustaining human life is fundamental to a free and ordered society. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jacob LaBelle, one of the original plaintiffs, who's now 21 years old. Here, LaBelle, who lives on a farm in southern Oregon, explains the legal challenges and outcomes and what he and his fellow plaintiffs hope to win.
What happened- happened is that the Trump administration actually filed with the Ninth Circuit, and basically it's an obscure piece of legalese called the writ of mandamus, rarely used. It's a desperate measure. You know, it's kind of last resort tactic. Basically, they were asking that the case not go to trial and go straight up to the Ninth Circuit Court, have the Ninth Circuit Court immediately review it, review the lower court's decision, which, if you know about legal matters, is highly unusual because the Ninth Circuit is the appellate court and it's the appeals court, and it's supposed to overview the decision that was reached by the lower court once you've gone through the discovery process and gone through trial. Like, it's not its job to oversee, you know, discovery or trial or whatever. It's just supposed to review the findings once the case is developed. So we weren't even getting the chance to develop the case and go to trial if the Trump administration had its way. So actually what happened is the Ninth Circuit said, okay, we'll review it and we'll let you know whether you can continue towards trial at the district court, the lower court, or whether we're going to step in. And that took a while, and we just got the decision that we got the go-ahead to go to trial, and we're back in the district court where we should be, and we're going to trial.
Jacob LaBelle, I know this case was originally filed against President Obama and his administration. And after Trump took office, I was in D.C. when the youth plaintiffs appeared at the U.S. Supreme Court to change the name of the suit from Giuliana v. Obama to Giuliana v. Trump, Kelsey Giuliana being the lead plaintiff. Who are you expecting to have testify?
The case is really about the U.S. government. It's not about particular individuals. That's kind of the beauty of our case, in a way, is that, you know, I think we do need efforts targeting particular companies, particular agencies, particular individuals who are, you know, corrupt and who are horribly worsening this problem for their own profit. That is great. What our case is doing is more of a systemic, trying to achieve systemic change through the legal system. And so we're addressing, like, decades of willful action by the U.S. government to worsen this problem of climate change by creating a fossil fuel-dependent energy system. So it's not about Obama or Trump. That's kind of my first point. However, it's kind of somewhat dramatic and somewhat, I don't know if it's poetic justice or whatever, that, you know, Trump is one of the most, as far as fossil fuel and corruption and climate change goes, is one of the most horrific, you know, politicians that we've ever had in power. If we win, it's kind of very fitting, I think, that we're fighting the Trump administration. There's no ambiguity there about what the moral stakes or values are on both sides. We're suing all the major agencies, you know, Department of the Interior, Department of Energy, the EPA, the White House. So they're all in there. And it all depends on, you know, what information we really need specifically, you know, what information that we can't get otherwise. I'll say that we were trying to depose Rex Tillerson.
In his capacity as head of ExxonMobil, right, before he became Trump's Secretary of State.
He was, originally, all the major fossil fuel companies had actually filed to intervene in our case.
And after Trump took office, the companies asked to withdraw, right, so they couldn't be deposed.
Once you enter a legal case, you can get deposed. And so they basically got in to throw us out because they thought this was going to be a really small, like, easy to throw out lawsuit. And then they completely got shut down by the judges. And then the case got really serious. It got so much press and it was moving forward. And suddenly, you know, they were going to be the ones getting deposed. And I think that's when they started to freak out and they filed to withdraw from the case, and the judge actually let them out, which was actually fine because it simplifies the case a lot. Because actually the Trump administration right now, as far as the legal front goes, it's not contesting the facts of climate change. It's actually not. So Obama actually, right before the Obama administration left, literally like a month before, actually filed a document that basically agreed with all of our assertions on the climate science. Including actually saying that it was going to be worse in some cases than what our lawyers were saying. What they disagreed on was the remedy and the government's role in that, in the historical, you know, burden on the government. But they didn't disagree with the climate science. So that's actually factual record in court. And actually, the Trump administration has not revoked that. And I don't even know if they still can.
Jacob, what exactly is the goal of the lawsuit? What do you want to get out of it?
There's no, you know, we're not asking for any type of money or money reparations. So that's the first point. The second point, what we're actually suing for is a national science-based climate recovery plan. That's the key phrase.
That was Jacob LaBelle, a plaintiff in Our Children's Trust climate lawsuit against the U.S. government. The case is expected to go to trial in about 6 months. Learn more about the lawsuit and related issues of climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the wake of the mass shooting at Parkland, Florida's Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School that left 17 dead on February 14th, a bipartisan group of legislators met with President Trump at the White House to discuss the epidemic of gun violence. At the conclusion of that meeting, Mr. Trump called for legislation that would strengthen background checks, address mental illness, and spoke in support of raising the age limit for the purchase of military-style assault rifles from 18 to 21 years old. In recognizing the difficulty of passing new gun control laws, the president repeatedly accused members of his own Republican Party of being afraid of the National Rifle Association. However, just 2 weeks later, after the president met with NRA officials in the Oval Office, the White House unveiled its plan to combat school shootings, which included a proposal to arm teachers, but no measure that would raise the age limit on buying assault rifles. A dramatic shift by the president, who now embraced the controversial policy positions of the NRA. The power and influence of the NRA has long been one of the major obstacles standing in the way of passing widely supported gun control legislation in Congress. Your reporter spoke with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, historian and author of the new book titled Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. Here she discusses the hidden origins of the NRA, which has transformed from a club promoting target shooting and hunting to an organization now identified with right-wing culture wars and white nationalism.
The National Rifle Association, which up to 1977 had been a pretty benign, kind of stupid organization for men, boys, you know, of target shooting and hunting, recreational shooting. You know, they never, ever talked about the Second Amendment. But a white nationalist organization, kind of neo-Nazis, they were anti-Semitic, anti-black. It was in the state of Washington, out in that eastern Washington, which is still a hotbed of white nationalism. This organization called the Second Amendment Foundation formed, and was very specifically about promoting the Second Amendment as a right, a way for them to arm themselves legally, because they were always getting busted for having all kinds of weapons, you know, automatic weapons and stuff. Because NRA was a membership organization, they began joining, and they got enough of a group, solid group together that got themselves elected, and they actually took over the leadership of the organization.
What was the year that this group took over the NRA?
1977.
So today's NRA, very different from the one that existed before the late 70s, they seem to be very much keyed into right-wing culture wars. And as you describe them, they also seem to push hot-button issues related to racism and white supremacy. Tell us a little bit about today's NRA and how you think they'll survive in a climate where the public is becoming ever more angry and outraged at this culture, which promotes the idea that the more guns, the better.
Well, they succeeded a lot, and their success is based not on money or bribing legislators. You know, that's an easy explanation and falls into the U.S. tendency of finding a culprit, a single culprit, and if you can just wipe that out, everything will be okay. But it's much scarier than that, because they are a membership organization, of 5 million. And a lot of them are passive members. They just want the discounts, you know, and the whatever. Apparently, among those, you know, they're actually losing some memberships over their radicalism. You know, it's not something everyone wants. or thing buys into the things they're getting into. But there is this core group of about a million. I mean, I'm talking about not a small conspiracy, but a mass-based organization. There's no way any organization on the left in the United States comes anywhere near those kinds of numbers of dedicated, hardcore volunteers. They're not being paid. They're citizens in every congressional district in the United States, and they make sure that anyone who's elected, either on the local level, because a lot of most gun laws are state laws, even the municipal level and the federal level, they've largely been the dedicated base that has brought Trump to the presidency and the entire Congress afraid of him, because all they have to do is send out the names. They watch what's going on in Washington, and they send out alerts. They become very much more effective with social media, just as other movements have. You know, it is a white nationalist, mass-based organization, and that's why it's so powerful. There's no way it could be that powerful as just an organization, no matter how much money they had. They actually don't operate with a whole lot of money, $300 million a year is their budget. And when they give to Congress members, it's usually like a gift, a thank you. You know, it's not really a contribution to their campaigns. They don't need it. They have the Koch brothers. They have, you know, these huge, rich, right-wing donors. They don't need the NRA's money. It's their political base. But the evangelicals, which are the largest single voting group in the United States, are allied, you know, with the NRA.
That was Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, historian and author of the new book titled Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. Her previous books include An Indigenous People's History of the United States and Outlaw Woman. Learn more about the hidden history of the Second Amendment and the origins of the NRA by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KSKQ in Ashland, Oregon, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.